Welcome to the 13th episode of Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Brandon Scalia. Onc Live On Air is a new podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. Onc Live is also home to the State of the Science Summits. These summits, which take place throughout the United States, are dedicated to the latest research in various therapeutic areas. That brings us to today's episode. On October 2nd, we travel to San Francisco, California for a State of the Science Summit on breast cancer. The meeting covered the use of CDK4/6 inhibitors in metastatic hormone receptor-positive breast cancer, adjuvant and neoadjuvant HER2-targeted in early-stage HER2-positive disease, immunotherapy and triple-negative disease, diagnostic assays in HR-positive, HER2-negative disease, and the I-SPY trials. In HR-positive breast cancer, CDK4/6 inhibitors have redefined how physicians treat patients. The three FDA-approved agents in this class are palbociclib, ribociclib, and abemaciclib for the treatment of patients with HR-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer. In 2018, abemaciclib and ribociclib received expanded approvals. Now, all three agents are approved in the first, second, or greater line settings. In HER2-positive disease, physicians have access to adjuvant neratinib and pertuzumab. In 2017, the FDA approved neratinib as extended adjuvant treatment for early-stage patients based on data from the Phase 2 EXTANET trial and Phase 2 CONTROL trial. Later that year, the FDA approved pertuzumab in combination with trastuzumab and chemotherapy based on the Phase 3 AFFINITY trial, which demonstrated a 3-year invasive disease-free survival rate of 94.1%. Pertuzumab is also approved as a neoadjuvant treatment in combination with docetaxel and trastuzumab. Though immunotherapy has yet to receive an approval in breast cancer, data from the Phase 3 IMpassion 130 trial demonstrated a reduction in the risk of disease progression or death with frontline atezolizumab and nab-paclitaxel versus nab-paclitaxel alone in patients with metastatic or unresectable triple-negative breast cancer. First, we sat down with the chair of the meeting, Hope Rugo, MD, a professor of medicine and director of the Breast Oncology Clinical Trials Program at the University of California, San Francisco, Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. Rugo spoke to the efforts with immunotherapy and TNBC, attesting to its promise in the field. She then segued into the use of CDK4/6 inhibitors in HR-positive disease, where she addressed their current and future applications, as well as understanding mechanisms of resistance. Rugo concluded her presentation by predicting the future treatment landscape, in which PI3K inhibitors seem to play a big part.
I talked about immunotherapy and triple-negative breast cancer. It's actually a really exciting area where we're learning more and more about the predictors of response. I think it's really enhanced by the recent press release for data that will be presented at ESMO from IMpassion 130. This trial looked at nab-paclitaxel as first-line chemotherapy for metastatic triple-negative breast cancer with either the checkpoint inhibitor atezolizumab or placebo, and actually reported in the press release that it met its primary endpoint in terms of progression-free survival, and also reported that there were encouraging overall survival results in the overall population and in the PD-L1 subset, PD-L1 positive subset. So this is actually really exciting data, and we expect it to lead to the first checkpoint inhibitor approval for the treatment of breast cancer. I think that's led to, based on the lower response rates for single agent checkpoint inhibitors, particularly in the second or greater line setting, an interest in moving checkpoint inhibitors early into treatment, an explosion of neoadjuvant and adjuvant clinical trials, post-neoadjuvant trials, as well as a look at what agents we could use as immune enhancers, so immune agonists, whether that's standard chemotherapy, radiation therapy. One trial called the TONIC trial looked at a little burst of different agents and found that doxorubicin given in two doses actually seemed to enhance the response to a checkpoint inhibitor. Again, very small data being tested now in a larger trial. And then immune agonists, so other antibodies that are being tested as either an initial lead-in or a lead-in followed by combination. It may be that the order is important. All of these things are under active investigation. There are studies looking at checkpoint inhibitors combined with other agents in hormone receptor positive disease, CDK4/6 inhibitors combined with checkpoint inhibitors. Very big interest based on fascinating preclinical work by Sham Goel in Boston. And then in HER2-positive disease also, there are a number of studies looking at combinations with checkpoint inhibitors. So the field of immunotherapy in breast cancer is really exploding. It's of great interest. And the sort of thing we're going to learn in addition to the right combinations is whether there are specific biomarkers, whether it's PD-L1 positivity, tumor infiltrating lymphocytes, or other factors that help us understand who responds. The one thing we've definitely learned is that as the cancers become more resistant to therapy and have a higher mutational burden, essentially, or potentially just more mutations in the wrong pathways, they become more resistant to immunotherapy along with everything else, so that we need to be tackling treatment earlier. Our neoadjuvant data in the I-SPY trial was really encouraging, with a tripling of the estimated PCR rate in the triple negative population and a near tripling in the PCR rate in the hormone receptor positive high risk population when the checkpoint inhibitor pembrolizumab was combined with neoadjuvant paclitaxel, then followed by AC. So our next generation studies have actually included the idea of enhancing the immune response by adding the PARP inhibitor olaparib with a checkpoint inhibitor durvalumab and paclitaxel, and also bringing up the question of whether or not, if you have a great response to pembrolizumab and paclitaxel, whether or not you really need an anthracycline. So the idea being patients who are responding to paclitaxel and pembrolizumab will get 4 more doses of pembrolizumab and not get AC, and then see what their response is at the time of surgery. So a lot of different areas of investigation there. I think, you know, some studies have shown less of a dramatic response to neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibition, but I think a lot of it has to do with the patient population that's selected and how the PCR is defined and reported. So I think that, you know, the field of treating hormone receptor positive advanced breast cancer has just really changed tremendously over the last 10, 12 years. We had the first approved drug for hormone receptor positive HER2 negative breast cancer with the mTOR inhibitor everolimus, an understanding of managing toxicity that's really changed the way we use that drug and how patients tolerate it. But still understanding that there were toxicities of everolimus that made it difficult for some patients, particularly our older patients or those with problems with glucose tolerance. So having the CDK4/6 inhibitors come on based on really robust preclinical data has been very exciting. We now have 3 CDK4/6 inhibitors, palbociclib, ribociclib, and abemaciclib, that are approved in the first and second or greater line settings in combination with endocrine therapy, and abemaciclib that's approved in later line treatment after chemotherapy as a single agent. We understand a lot more about the toxicities of these agents with neutropenia, other less serious, usually toxicities. We know that a small number of patients with ribociclib may have QT prolongation, that abemaciclib is given continuously and has more diarrhea, but that can be managed with dose reductions and patient education as well as dose delays. We also understand that fatigue is an issue with these medications, as well as some degree of alopecia, occasionally abnormal liver enzymes with some of the agents. So we've learned a lot. We know that we can partner these drugs in the postmenopausal patients, in premenopausal women on ovarian suppression. We know, for example, that doesn't appear to be safe to combine tamoxifen with ribociclib because in the premenopausal population, because you may actually enhance the QT effect of that drug, so that shouldn't be given. On the other hand, we know that fulvestrant can be given safely with all 3 different CDK4/6 inhibitors, even in the first line setting, based on the Mona Lisa trial, and it seems to be safe and effective. So where we're going, actually, first, we know that progression-free survival is essentially doubled with the addition of a CDK4/6 inhibitor. We will see the data from Paloma 3 in terms of survival shortly, actually, at ESMO. And I think that will be really fascinating to understand the impact on survival and if there's a subpopulation of patients who benefit. We've been really interested in trying to understand resistance to these drugs, both upfront and acquired, subpopulations that have more benefit. Certainly in the Paloma studies, it's been impossible to identify a subpopulation that doesn't benefit from CDK4/6 inhibitors. Except for maybe those who have upfront mutations in the retinoblastoma gene, because those patients are, if you're missing RB, then it's very hard for CDK4/6 inhibitors to have an impact. That thankfully is a very small percentage of patients. Looking at acquired or even to in some patients upfront mechanisms of resistance, mutated cyclin E has emerged as a very interesting biomarker of resistance, as well as, and certainly when you have more cyclin E around, that may be the problem where you're able to overcome that effect of the CDK4/6 inhibitors. And then there are other mechanisms that have been looked at, and really elegant data with the fibroblast growth factor receptor overexpression, et cetera. So there are a number of trials looking at ways of trying to overcome those mechanisms of resistance, and also looking at cell-free DNA as one way to try and identify those mechanisms. We're moving the CDK4/6 inhibitors into the early stage breast cancer setting, which I think is critical to understand impact both in post-neoadjuvant trials and adjuvant trials, focusing on a very high-risk ER-positive population. There will be over 15,000 women treated in early stage CDK4/6 inhibitor trials. So hopefully we'll have data in the next few years about whether or not we can actually cure more women with ER-positive breast cancer. I think one of the important things in these studies, which is going to be really fascinating, is the need for a very long-term follow-up, because we're seeing, certainly in the early breast cancer trialist recent publication, that even with stage one breast cancer, we're seeing 14% of patients with recurrent disease after 5 years of adjuvant endocrine therapy out to 20 years. So, you know, that can go up to 50% in patients who have higher risk multi-node positive breast cancer. So, you know, could we use CDK4/6 inhibitors to sort of nip the disease in the bud so you don't have dormancy and late recurrences? That's what we're going to be fascinating to see as we look at these trials over time. It's also going to be really important to evaluate quality of life and make sure that we're not making everybody exhausted for all those years. You know, then identifying the patients who are most likely to benefit will be critical. It's going to be interesting because the NATALEE trial, which is supposed to open later this year, which is going to be the ribociclib adjuvant trial, will use 3 years of a CDK4/6 inhibitor. That's a long time, so it's going to be interesting to see what the compliance is with longer durations, because we found certainly that even 2 years is a long time in the adjuvant setting, although people with high-risk disease will definitely stick with it to a large part.
Following Dr. Rugo, we spoke with Michelle Melisco, MD, a clinical professor of medicine at the UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. Melisco assessed the value of available assays in HR-positive, HER2-negative breast cancer as evaluated in the TAILOR-X and MINDAC trials. In TAILOR-X, adjuvant endocrine therapy alone was shown to be non-inferior to adjuvant chemoendocrine therapy in patients with early-stage HR-positive, HER2-negative, node-negative breast cancer. Investigators used the Oncotype DX breast recurrence score to discern the value of hormone therapy plus chemotherapy versus hormone therapy alone in women with intermediate-risk breast cancer. The higher the score, the higher the risk of recurrence. In the MINDAC trial, MammaPrint was used to assess risk of recurrence following surgery. The assay was shown to be a clinically useful tool in high-risk patients with node-positive grade 3 disease. When we spoke to Melisco, she highlighted the nuances between the studies, illuminating the scenarios in which each assay is most appropriate.
I think that that many patients come in with the expectation that they need one of these tests, and I think that, of course, the companies would love if we ordered one or the other on every single patient. But there are definitely, you know, patients, and you know, part of it is age dependent, part of it is preference dependent. You know, none of this takes away from the need to talk to the patient and find out what their what their biases are. If you have a patient that is going to decline chemotherapy no matter what you do, it may not be worth ordering the test. And again, there are patients that have very, very low risk, you know, what appears to be very biologically low risk cancer, or elderly patients where we're not thinking of chemotherapy anyway, that I think that neither of the tests are going to be very helpful. There is data, and this was not part of my official presentation, but with the MammaPrint, some work that was done at our center by Laura Esterman, looking at a data set of patients that were treated in Sweden, a study that was like 20 years old. So they have long-term follow-up, and these patients received either no endocrine therapy or a short course of endocrine therapy of just 2 years. And there is, they basically applied the MammaPrint to that patient population, and they found that there's a threshold under which patients can have a phenomenal outcome, you know, 97% chance of being alive and without recurrence of cancer at 20 years with only 2 years of endocrine therapy. And so there may be an ability to use a test like the MammaPrint to identify patients that don't even need endocrine therapy. And that's another important point about the Oncotype, is all of the prognostic information that it provides is that a patient has agrees and will take and be compliant with their 5 years of endocrine therapy. And so that's, you know, another thing that patients, they see their Oncotype score says they're low risk, and 2 years into their endocrine therapy, they're saying, I really hate this. I don't like the body aches, I don't like the joint pains, I don't like the hot flashes, I don't like the mood swings, I'm stopping it because I have a low Oncotype, and that's not the right approach.
Jumping to HER2-positive disease was A. Jo Chen, MD, an associate clinical professor in the Department of Medicine at the UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center. She addressed the challenges in identifying the patients who can get more and those who can get less treatment. In her lecture, Chen navigated the landscape of early-stage HER2-positive breast cancer, focusing on who should receive each therapy, now that pertuzumab is approved in both the neoadjuvant and adjuvant settings, and eratinib is indicated as extended adjuvant therapy.
Pertuzumab is approved in both the neoadjuvant and the adjuvant setting, and we've seen from Affinity that in the overall population, the benefit is about 1-2%. However, in the higher risk patients, like those who are node positive and hormone receptor negative, the benefit is a little bit larger. So certainly, I would consider adding pertuzumab for those patients. And I don't know that recurrence is the only meaningful endpoint. We know that giving pertuzumab in the neoadjuvant setting can increase PCR and therefore increase rates of breast conservation, and potentially can minimize axillary surgery. I think how we manage the axilla is evolving as we're giving more neoadjuvant chemotherapy. So I think those are really meaningful endpoints for patients as well. I think those who we're taking to surgery first because they have small amounts of disease probably don't need adjuvant pertuzumab in general. And then for neratinib, similarly, we're seeing that patients who have higher risk, who are node positive, who have residual disease after neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and especially those that are hormone receptor positive, that's where we've seen the greatest benefit, may be the ones to really focus our the neratinib for.
Physicians have made tremendous strides across the spectrum of breast cancers, and in our interview with Laura J. Esterman, MD, she spoke about means of accelerating these advances for those at high risk of early recurrence in the I-SPY trials. Esterman is a professor at the UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center and 2018 Giant of Cancer Care for Cancer Diagnostics.
Well, I would say that there's three or four key things about I-SPY. Number one, we test drugs where they matter most. So moving the drug testing earlier at a time they're curable, and we actually hypothesize that some drugs might work even better in the setting and have shown that. The second thing we've done is we've changed the order of therapy. It's really important to be able to, if you want to speed up progress, you have to have an early endpoint, and you have to have a valid endpoint. And we didn't have that to start, but we have it now. And what we know is that the order of therapy doesn't change outcomes. You can start with chemotherapy or you can operate. But if you operate first, you really have no idea how every individual is going to respond. And I think that's been a real obstacle for us in changing therapy because we have had decades where we operate on people and then give the drugs blindly. We really don't have an early indicator of who's responding. We just have to wait until people recur. So I think that's really impeded our ability to rapidly learn and improve our approach to people. So then the third thing we do is we use imaging and biomarker guidance. And what that means is we can follow along and use the imaging, the MRI imaging, to see what kind of response people are having. And the biomarkers are, in addition to our standard biomarkers, to take these kind of new and emerging markers of tumor biology to really figure out how to best tailor the drugs to the right person. And the fourth thing I would say is very important is to really, the ways in which we've really changed the efficiency as we created a master protocol, a platform trial, and used adaptive design. And so what does that mean? So master protocol means you don't write a new protocol every time you want to bring a new drug in. What you do is you have one protocol, and every drug comes in as an amendment. It's very efficient. It's the first time ever that we got all the drug companies that participated to put their drugs into the same trial. But that's much more efficient. And the we've worked with the FDA on this and the NCI at the time. And the other piece is the adaptive design. As you know, what we were doing at the beginning is trying to see if a drug is working better for a particular patient group or particular biology, it would be more likely to be given to the next person who came into the trial with that same biology. That's critical. That's a real frame shift in the way we do trials. Most people think, oh, got to test A versus B, and you can't look, and that would really screw everything up. But like, you wouldn't drive your car with your eyes closed. Why would you test new agents that way? I don't know. I'm the PI of the trial. I don't know how it works. But the statistician team, they know because the engine is working to evaluate it. And so we don't, it minimizes the chance of giving people therapies that don't help them as much, and it maximizes the chance the people who are benefiting most are going to benefit. And what we're kind of unveiling is our next stage, sort of where we're going next. I think we've sort of reached a landmark in the trial. We've had enough, we've had, you know, well over 1,000 patients on the trial. We've had enough follow-up for about 750 patients, such that we can now say that a complete response to the therapy, so if that means if the tumor's gone away by the time you go to the operating room, that is absolutely predictive of like a 95% distant recurrence-free survival. And that's really huge. And we've shown that that's true even with novel therapies. So no matter what the biology, no matter what the drug, if you get that endpoint in this particular group of patients at high risk for early recurrence, you are going to do well. So either complete or near complete response. So that's hugely meaningful.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to the 13th episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Wednesdays for new interviews from our State of the Science Summits. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit OncLive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. We have two upcoming State of the Science Summits for those interested in attending. If you want to hear more on the therapeutic advances in breast cancer, consider registering for the State of the Science Summit on October 31st in Pittsburgh. You can also catch us in Washington, D.C., on November 1st for a State of the Science Summit on lung cancer. You can register now at onclive.com/stateofthesciencesummit. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, you can follow us at @OncLive and @OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts. You can get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.